On the heels of his endorsement by the Florida Times Union, this morning we speak with 4th District Congressional candidate John Rutherford. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9, and make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app. And just ahead, Rutherford, a Republican, and two opponents, Democrat Dave Bruderle and NPA candidate Gary Konas, are all on the ballot to replace the retiring Andrew Crenshaw. In just a moment, John Rutherford will take your calls. You can call in right now and join the conversation at 549-2937. Then later, it's an afternoon of networking and education for girls on the First Coast. We'll tell you about Generation Wow. Plus, in Going Green, a look at how a number of Florida's historic sites could be affected by rising seas. All of that ahead. But first this hour, when longtime Florida Congressman Andrew Crenshaw announced his retirement earlier this year, it launched a scramble to replace him in Washington. Former Duval County Sheriff John Rutherford announced his candidacy for the job, and he quickly won the support of many major Republican officials in the district. With less than 2 weeks to go until Election Day, this morning we welcome John Rutherford to the studio as he talks about his campaign and takes your calls. John Rutherford, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa. Good to be with you again. And it's always great to come over.
Thanks so much. And lots of calls already for former Sheriff John Rutherford as we discuss his campaign for Congress in District 4 here in North Florida. The number to join us, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet us or weigh in on our Facebook page. We're already getting your comments there, and we will get to as many of those as we can in just a few minutes. And as I mentioned, you've received the endorsement of the Florida Times Union calling you the best qualified person to succeed Andrew Crenshaw in Congress, in particular due to your 4 decades of service with the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. How do you see yourself as the best candidate in this race, given that your background is in law enforcement, and this, of course, would be a different way of serving the public?
Exactly, Melissa. And I think, you know, one of the highlights of my career that a lot of people are not aware of is the fact that my first year in office as sheriff, having just come out of the Department of Corrections, I was seriously concerned about the mental health issues over in the Department of Corrections. So I drafted a bill, took it to the Florida Sheriff's Association, tried to get that bill passed, and tried to get it onto the FSA agenda because I was a junior sheriff. I couldn't get it on there. So I said, well, look, do you mind if I run it on my own? And they said, sure, go ahead. So I ran that bill through Tallahassee, and it failed. So as I sat back to analyze it, because I had a great bill. I mean, it was going to get mentally ill people out of corrections, out of the criminal justice system, and into treatment. And I'm like, how can this thing fail? And you know, as I analyzed it, what I realized was I had lots of relationships and coalitions built in Jacksonville, but I didn't have any with those people over in Tallahassee. And so I spent the next year going over, meeting, you know, getting to know folks and finding out what their concerns were and building those coalitions and relationships on both sides of the aisle. And so the next year, I tried to get my bill onto the Florida Sheriff's Association agenda again. Couldn't. So I asked if I might run it again by myself, and they said, sure, go ahead. And the bill flew through. Well, then the executive director comes to me and he says, John, I want you to know we just elected you legislative chairman for the Florida Sheriff's Association. And I said, okay, I would love to do that. And so I had no idea I was going to be doing that for the next 9 years. I continued to be elected for 9 years. And so I have some very, very good legislative experience lobbying the legislature and working bills, amending bills, and quite frankly, killing bills. But it's all about relationships, and it's all about knowing the issues in your community. And
what do you see as the biggest issues for this district?
The biggest issues for this district are, look, I see Jacksonville and Northeast Florida poised to be the logistics hub for the entire Eastern Seaboard. We have so many things working for us. We've spent millions of dollars already at the port to bring in near rail capabilities. We have all of that land that is now light industrial zoned out on the north side for those distribution centers. We have the highways. We have the rail. We even have the civil aviation out at Cecil Field. We have every mode of transportation necessary to make us the logistics hub. And we have, quite frankly, the recurve of the continent that helps us, because if you go due north from Jacksonville, it is Cleveland, Ohio. And so that's how far inland we actually are from the rest of the continent. And so that gives us a unique opportunity. So our port economic development is very important for all of Northeast Florida.
And we'll go to your calls for former Sheriff John Rutherford in a moment as he talks about his campaign for Congress. It's 549-2937. And, of course, you've talked a lot on the campaign trail about other issues like a balanced budget amendment, cutting the size of the federal government, ending corporate welfare, reining in federal regulations, finding ways to trim down the $19 trillion in federal debt. Your opponent, mm-hmm. David Bruderle, and there's also an NPA candidate running against you, Gary Conas, have tried to portray you as too far to the right on some of these issues. And they've criticized your record as sheriff, saying that we did still see high crime rates during much of your tenure. What would you say to your opponents?
Well, you left out also strengthening our military. That's an important goal as well. I would say this. In 2011, Jacksonville had the lowest violent crime and murder numbers we had seen in over 40 years. That was because we worked the entire pie, as I used to call it. We worked on prevention, intervention, and enforcement. And so when we convinced the mayor's office to give us the resources that we needed, we were able to then go into those neighborhoods, fight crime the way we needed to. We had great prosecution following that up with Angela Corey. And as a result, by 2011, we had the lowest crime numbers we'd seen in 40 years. But then
we continued to see a high homicide rate.
No, not then. Not in 2011. We see
but
it now.
But off and on, we've been the murder capital of Florida for over a decade.
Well, let me explain what happened. After 2011, what happened in 2011? Mayor Alvin Brown was elected, came to town, cut 147 police officers, cut 92 community service officers. That's when violent crime and murder went back up. And so,
but according to the FDLE, we've held the title of murder capital for off and on for over 10 years, not just during Alvin Brown's administration.
No.
What would you say to critics of your tenure saying that we continued to see high crime during your tenure?
My point is this. During my tenure, you saw the lowest murder rate in violent crime. If Mayor Alvin Brown had left it alone, left us with those resources, it would have stayed down. But instead, in 2011, when he was elected, we had the lowest murder numbers, lowest violent crime numbers. And look, that's why this community made him a one-term mayor. And so they understood exactly what happened. They gave us the resources to do our job. We were very successful with it, and violent crime and crime in this community went down to historically low levels.
Let me ask you a follow-up question on another matter. When Donald Trump was in town earlier this year, you appeared at his rally, and as Republicans up and down the ballot here in Florida and around the country disavow Donald Trump's remarks about women that have offended many, and also his claim that he might not accept the results of the election if he loses. A number of Republicans have called those disqualifying remarks, and they've expressed concerns that his campaign could throw control of the Senate and maybe even the House, although that's far less likely, to the Democrats. Do you continue to stand by Donald Trump at the top of your ticket?
Yes, I do, and here's why. For me, Melissa, it comes down to one issue, the United States Supreme Court. Look, if Hillary Clinton is elected and the United States Supreme Court is stacked with liberal-leaning judges, we will lose our Second Amendment. We will lose our First Amendment rights. I am very concerned about the strength of the United States Constitution if the United States Supreme Court, the majority of it, could be appointed by Hillary Clinton. Yes, I know Donald Trump has said a lot of very bad things, done some bad things, but certainly you don't think Hillary Clinton is clean either. She's done some things that are equally horrific. So it comes down to that one issue, the United States Supreme Court. I also heard yesterday, when he was in St. Augustine, I was there and happened to hear his speech. I wish that Donald Trump had been giving that speech for the last 4 or 5 months. He would be 20 points up. It was very pragmatic, very, you know, he talked about a term limit amendment for the Constitution, the term limit Congress, and those things. I think he had some very salient points in his 100-day plan.
So you disagree with a number of your colleagues in Congress, both senators and members of Congress, who you would join if you're elected, who've called him dangerous, sociopathic, unsound, uninformed, unhinged, and unfit to be president. I'm quoting from such Republicans mm-hmm. as former governor of Minnesota Tim Pawlenty, Senator John McCain, Senator Murkowski of Alaska, Susan Collins of Maine, Senator Mike Lee of Utah. So many Republicans, it's virtually unprecedented to see so many esteemed Republicans calling the top of their mm-hmm. ticket unfit, saying he's doing incalculable damage to mm-hmm. the GOP.
Well, and I would ask all of those Republicans, do you want to turn the United States Supreme Court over to Hillary Clinton? And I think they would unanimously tell you no.
Let's go to your calls now for John Rutherford. He's running for Congress. Let's begin in Nassau with Dave. It's 549-2937. Hi, Dave. You're on the air. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. My question is this. This country does face an existential threat, but it's not terrorism, it's climate change. And I'd like to know whether or not you accept climate science, because there is no discussion within the scientific community. Climatologists all agree that climate change is happening, and it's happening as a result of man-made emission of greenhouse gases. Do you accept that science, and will you take steps to help this state, which is the most vulnerable to climate change, in addressing that concern?
Mm-hmm. Well, I do accept that the climate is changing. I think you can look back over history and see that climate is changing and has always changed. Now, the challenge is how much of that is being impacted by man, and how much of it is just a natural occurrence of the global systems, and that's where I'm not sure that man is the sole cause of all of the climate change that we see.
So you do not accept the. Really, it's the let me just say, Glow Smith, who was here yesterday and is running for Congress in Kareem Brown's district, was asked the same question by a caller, and I asked her the same question. Will you work with a number of federal agencies, NOAA, NASA, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, who have not only accepted the reality of rising seas and human impacts contributing to a warming planet, but are actively already mitigating against the damage they expect in coastal communities here in Florida?
Yes, absolutely, because the climate is changing. So we have to prepare for mitigation. That's regardless of the cause. We have to prepare for the effect. What the root cause is, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that I trust the science. I'm not sure.
Why not? As I mentioned, these federal agencies have accepted this science.
Well, let me tell you, sometimes these federal agencies are using some pretty poor processes. For example, the red snapper ban. You go out to, NOAA will tell you that red snapper are endangered. We can't fish them. Yet I'm told that the way that they determine the number out there of fish in the ocean is they drag a net over a sandy bottom. Well, red snapper happen to be reef fish. So you got to go down and count them. You can't drag a net over the sand and say that there are no red snapper out there. That's not where they hang out. So divers will tell you, they've told me, Sheriff, you can go down there and you can walk across the red snapper. They're so thick down there.
But let me ask you, this has been studied for decades, and the scientific consensus, frankly, is not in doubt. It's simply not true.
I'm not sure that that is true. Look, there are many scientists that disagree with that.
That's not true. And the federal government, which, by the way, these agencies are nonpartisan, they simply look at the data and they act on it to protect coastal communities. You're going to be representing a coastal community if you're elected.
Yes.
And if you're not in accord with the scientific consensus about this problem that's going to affect many millions of people along the coastline, how can you work in concert with these agencies to protect citizens?
But what I can tell you is I will look at the science that they present. But if it's like the science that they're presenting about the fisheries, then I'm going to question their findings.
All right, let's go to some more calls. By the way, the lines are jammed as we speak with John Rutherford. Mike on the south side. Go ahead, Mike.
Hey, I think John Rutherford's working real hard at losing my vote. This has been an interesting conversation. First off, support of Trump. Wow. And he gets to the heart of the argument that a lot of people have, you know, that we've got to protect the Supreme Court. But, man, if you really hate the idea of Hillary and packing the Supreme Court, that you want to put a clown show like Donald Trump in office, that's wow. I'm interested, though, in talking about Michelle Corum's question to you about working across the aisle. You're looking to get into the House, and the House is arguably looking to lose some members of the Republican Party. And I think I'd like to hear more about your willingness to work across the aisle, because I think a lot of people, I'm an ex-Republican, I'm now in PA, and I left the Republican Party over this intransigence about 12 years ago. Yeah, 12 years ago. I'm pretty sick of it. I'm really sick of this drag to the right. I'm fed up with it. You lost me, you've lost a lot of other people. And to her point previously, there have been a lot of people, not a lot of them in the House, but there have been a lot of people, a lot of good Republicans, a lot of more moderate and sane Republicans who, you know, had enough with, you know, Trump has kind of risen the whole thing up and gotten people looking at this intransigence. And I think we're pretty sick of it. And I think what a lot of people really want to hear from some Republican, you know, there's some that want to hear that you're going to continue to attack harder to the right and go more conservative. I think there are a lot more that are so bloody sick of this intransigence and this following the Hastert rule of not passing any legislation that wasn't passed by the majority. You know, I'd like to hear some more with regards to that from you.
Yeah, thank you, Mike.
Okay, Mike, thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mike, because I tell you, listen, I agree with you. The Washington Post, did a very interesting piece where they tracked the voting patterns of Democrats and Republicans going back to 1949 all the way up to 2011. And back in 1949, what you saw was, it was like one big purple dot. You know, the colors were all mixed up, the red and blue. By 2011, you have a red dot and a blue dot. There is no voting across party lines, and actually what's happened is the ideologues have taken over on both sides, and all they do is demonize the other side. And I am not of that ilk. I've said many times on the campaign trail that I am about working both sides of the aisle to get things done for our community and our country. Look, I believe in a thing called incrementalism, where if a bill comes through and it gives me 75 or 80% of what I think is important to my community and our country, I'll vote for that if that's the best I can get. And then we'll go after the rest of it later. But the idea is we have to start moving forward. Now, I'll tell you what's interesting. The appropriations process has to change, because that is why the ideologues have been able to take over. And that's why there hasn't been a budget passed for these many years, because they are no longer negotiating and coming together to control the dollars and where the dollars are being spent, where they're going. Because now they pass appropriation bills that go to the executive branch. They decide how it's going to be spent, not the congressman. And that is why you can't get anybody to the table to work together, because they've mm-hmm. taken that out of it, the appropriations process. And quite frankly, I'm not sure that Congress didn't do this on purpose, because they don't have to put their name on it, just like the regulatory process. You know, that they allow the executive branch, these executive branch agencies, to literally legislate by fiat, and no one can hold these bureaucrats accountable. They don't even know who they are, but they're passing all these regulatory changes. Mm-hmm. That's why I support the REINS Act, R-E-I-N-S. And go look that up, Mike. And what it does is it pulls that regulatory process back into Congress where it belongs, and will force congressmen to come together and make these regulatory decisions. Where it needs to be made, not in these organizations like NOAA and others. They should be presenting to Congress what their findings are, and then Congress should be making those decisions, not these executive branch agencies. They're not there to legislate or regulate.
Let me just jump in because there are jam lines to try to speak with you. And I just want to make good use of our time.
Sure.
Lots of calls. let's try to get at least a few more of you on. It's Susanna in Jacks Beach. Go ahead, Susanna.
Hi. With all due respect, Mr. Rutherford, Hillary Clinton that will not have the power to undo the Second Amendment. Presidents don't have that power. And frankly, the Supreme Court is not going to do that all in one fell swoop. A lot of what you're saying makes absolutely no sense. I will be embarrassed to have as a representative a person that knows so little. That's all I want to say.
Well, you've never been shy about taking calls about people that don't agree
exactly.
with you. Your answer.
Susanna, listen. You're naive if you believe that the president does not have influence over the appointments to the Supreme Court. The president makes them. And then you have the advice and consent of the Senate that actually fills those appointments based on the presidential recommendations. So I don't know how you can say that.
And by the way, here's an email for you about the Supreme Court from Maryland and Palm Coast. Mr. Rutherford, the Supreme Court has been conservative for two generations. Do you believe it should always be conservative and one-sided, given that you're supporting Donald Trump, mainly because you're concerned about the high court?
I don't think that the Supreme Court should be liberal or conservative. I think it should interpret the Constitution strictly and not to the contrary. And if you consider that conservatism— then yes, I think it should be a conservative court. But if you just agree that the Constitution is a set document that needs to be interpreted as it was written and meant by the founding fathers, if that's conservative, yes. But liberal is certainly what we see among a lot of our United States Supreme Court justices. Like Ruth Bader Ginsburg and some others.
You do not want to see more justices in the vein of Ginsburg appointed.
No.
Yeah. Okay. Let's take a Jimmy in Jacksonville. Hi, Jimmy. Good morning.
How you doing? Thanks so much for taking my call. So, Mr. Rutherford, I have a question. Before in the primaries, you mentioned that Black Lives Matter is, you know, some sort of hate group. And I find that a little bit concerning, especially given how many African-Americans there are in the Northeast Florida region. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you think that really qualifies you to be representative for our region when there's just so many African-Americans who feel completely opposite to what you're saying.
Absolutely, Jimmy, and I'm going to tell you why. Because I am a statesman. I'm not a politician. And I'm going to tell you what I believe.
You're running for office.
And what I believe, what I believe you need to know. I hope you're as concerned that five dead police officers or two dead police officers in New York City were murdered shortly after this group marched down the streets of New York chanting, "What do we want? Dead cops. When do we want them? Now." And wrap them up in bacon, fry them like bacon, or wrap them up in dough, fry them like bacon. If that is not hate speech, I don't know what is. And listen, They may not go out and actually commit the violent acts, but they certainly are lighting the fuse under these folks to go out and commit these violent acts. That's why we wound up with 5 dead police officers in Dallas, Texas, 3 in New Orleans. So, yes, they are a hate group. And look, I think people are starting to understand that the rhetoric that they're spewing is wrong.
What would you say to those who disagree, who while they deplore the deaths of police officers, who, by the way, those officers in Dallas were there to defend the Black Lives Matter demonstrators.
Right.
And while, as horrific as that was, what would you say to those like the caller who are equally concerned about the shooting of unarmed Black men by those in uniform and who do not see BLM as a hate group?
I would tell them that law enforcement is not targeting Black men and Black lives, as has been suggested by the Black Lives Matter group. In fact, there's 3 studies have recently come out to show that that is not the case. In fact, that there's a higher propensity of police officers shooting white felons versus Black felons. So that's why I say the rhetoric and the science is wrong on that issue. Look, I was a police officer for 41 years. Yes, sometimes you have bad situations that occur out there. But I can tell you, when you look at the millions of arrests that are made by law enforcement across this country every year, and the number of questionable shootings, it's very, very low.
As you seek to transition from, it's been more than 4 decades in law enforcement to representing this district in Washington, if you're successful, you talked about the importance of this area as a logistics hub. When you go and you give your closing arguments to your potential future constituents, what will be your overriding priority if you're elected to serve?
I think the overriding priority is fixing our economy, the RAINS Act, tax reform, development more locally, developing our port, strengthening our military. But everything begins with the economy. Now, Grover Norquist, the American Taxpayer Reform, will tell you that if we fix the regulatory process, fix the tax structure, our GDP could be growing at 4% a year instead of 1%. And that would allow us to do a lot of other things that need to be done in this country to keep us safe, strengthen our military, and helping to take care of folks at home.
Well, we thank
through you. Things like Matthew, you know, this Hurricane Matthews and those things.
Well, we thank you so much for being with us. And again, early voting is underway now. And so we're always so gratified when candidates standing for office join this program. John Rutherford, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you. And much more still ahead. We'll be right back.
Legal and political segments on First Coast Connect, brought to you by Farrah & Farrah.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Goodwill of North Florida. Donate, shop, jobs. Good things for North Florida with Goodwill. Proud supporters of WJCT's First Coast Connect. GoodwillJax.org for more info.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, new data show Affordable Care Act premiums will increase by an average of 25% next year. But more than 8 in 10 consumers could be cushioned from those price hikes through subsidies. The Affordable Care Act, rising costs, subsidies, and its future in the next administration.
at 10 o'clock on 89.9 WJZT, your community, your world.
November 11th of each year is the day that we ensure veterans know that we deeply appreciate the sacrifices they have made in their lives to keep our country free. Help WJCT honor our veterans during the month of November by submitting a name we may add to our on-air thank you announcements. Go to wjct.org/veterans.
Welcome back. Well, it's a program that hasn't as yet gotten widespread attention, but one that's focused on a vital mission, saving Florida's archaeological sites threatened by sea level rise. The Florida Public Archaeology Network, like many other local, state, and federal agencies, is mobilizing to protect resources in the Sunshine State threatened by rising seas. We're taking a closer look in today's Going Green as we welcome Sarah Miller, director of the Northeast and East Central Region of FPAN, the Archaeology Network, and Emily Jane Murray, coordinator with the same organization. Ladies, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
And let's begin with you. You realized, Sarah, a few years ago that the Florida Department of State estimated some 16,000 resources would be affected with just 3 feet of sea level rise. So you began a program, a monitoring program of these sites. Tell us about it.
Yeah, there has been a lot done to inventory the sites in the state over the last 100 years. But since they've been recorded for the Florida Master Site File, a lot of these sites have not been visited again. And we're not really sure what the impacts will be from storm surge, sea level rise, all the many threats posed by climate change. So our idea was to get boots on the ground and eyes on those sites and ground truth some of those potential impacts, and also just to get out and enjoy them while they're still there in place.
And let's talk about some of the sites listeners in this area might know about. Like, for example, I'm just thinking out loud, the Castillo de San Marcos in St. Augustine, which is on the water.
Yeah.
But there are many others, right?
Yes. There are over 40,000 sites listed on the Florida Master Site File, so many along here in the Northeast area. We have the Castillo de San Marcos. Kingsley Plantation is a really important site here in Jacksonville area, and it is coastal. It's right on some of the marshes and the waterways.
Now, how will this program work? Because you've set up what is known as Heritage Monitoring Scouts. So it's a volunteer program engaging the public to monitor sites in threatened coastal environments, gather information, and manage and plan for any impact. How is this going to work, and how can people be part of it?
So the first step is to get onto our website, fpan.us/HMS Florida, and you can fill out a scout application. So anyone is welcome to join and be a part of the program. We do offer some training programs to get people familiar with the types of things we're looking at, how to identify sites, how to identify the threats to the sites, and then we will begin giving people different sites to go visit and check out.
And you're even doing something called the Cemetery Dash, a way to protect historic cemeteries. That's kind of a cool thing to do at this time of year around Halloween. How is that going to work?
Yeah, so the focus will be to get people out monitoring the cemetery. So we have lots of historic cemeteries in Duval County, lots in St. John's County and Nassau County. We've already seen the impacts, especially with Matthew, of some of the storm surge and the strong winds have knocked down a lot of trees. So getting people to go assess some of the damage to that, it kind of worked out perfectly, unfortunately.
Sure. And you've been working on this since 2013. In the previous segment, as we spoke with John Rutherford, candidate for Congress, about Florida and how it is uniquely threatened by sea level rise in the coming decades. What would you say to those listening who, they hear a lot about this, but perhaps, as we discussed in the prior segment, they're not convinced that the science is accurate. They're not convinced that it's as big an issue as climate scientists are sounding off about.
I mean, it's absolutely certain that we've seen sea level rising in the last 100 years. Sea level is rising at a rate 20% faster in Florida than the global average. So we have to tackle this problem in a unique way that other places in the world do not. The other issue is one of our friends who does climate change talks, he said he can't even keep his slides up to date. Every time he gives a presentation, he has to update the information it's rising 80% faster than the UNESCO estimates as well. So it is happening now. It's been happening for a while. And, you know, we're beyond time to get ready.
And FPAN and this program is going to move through 7 counties in the Northeast Florida region. What are those counties?
We cover just in the Northeast region, Nassau, Duval, St. John's, Clay, Putnam, Volusia, and Flagler County. But FPAN is a statewide program, so we have 7 other regional offices that cover the rest of the state.
Again, it's Today's Going Green as we talk about the Florida Public Archaeology Network as they seek to protect the state's most vulnerable historic sites. Thanks so much for being with us, Emily Jane Murray and Sarah Miller. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
This Going Green segment is brought to you by the Unitarian Universalist Church of Jacksonville.
Companies here compete in a global economy, sometimes at a disadvantage.
We are all about hiring the best engineers, the best product managers, the best folks out there. And I think that there's a shortage of talent like that in the United States.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Immigration Part 2 on our series How the Deck is Stacked, next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT's Generation Listen, the nonpartisan Jax Young Voters Coalition, and the Elements of MOSH present Why Vote Jax 2, an election-themed listening party event for young public radio listeners. Come to the rooftop of MOSH on Friday, November 4th from 6:30 to 9 p.m. for this free gathering featuring food, drinks, prizes, and great stories as heard on public radio. Learn more and RSVP at wjct.org/events. WJCT's Generation Listen is sponsored by Grassroots Natural Market.
Unlock your newest member benefit. Over 1,000 episodes of your favorite PBS shows. American Masters. Antiques Roadshow. Nature. Nova. Masterpiece. Watch the best of PBS anytime, anywhere. Become a member. Sign in and start streaming today.
WJCT.org/passport.
Welcome back. Well, Generation WOW is coming up on the UNF campus, and it's an empowering afternoon of networking and education for this area's high school girls. It follows on the heels of Generation W, a leadership conference for women in Jacksonville. And coming up on November 2nd, the workshops will be focused on girls and issues that are important to them. Donna Orender, creator of Generation W and Gen WOW, is here with a preview. Good morning.
Melissa, do you know that only 1 in 5 girls believe she has the key qualities required to be a good leader?
I do know that, and I have 2 daughters, and so this is of great concern to me, Donna, and
right?
Thanks for pointing that out.
And 74% of girls say they're under pressure to please everyone. Don't you think that number sounds low?
Yeah, I think it's 100% of girls probably feel that way.
You know, at a time when leadership matters more than ever, at a time when talent is a global competition, where are our leaders and where are our women and girls? And we have a real responsibility to help them take their rightful and earned place, in leadership ranks. And it's a wonderful, fun-filled, positive, and possible. But there's a real need for all of us to really create a community that includes all of us.
Yeah. And you've started that process, of course, with Generation W, and that is a leadership event for women. But as you're trying to grow the next generation of female leadership, Generation WOW focuses specifically on high school girls and really lifts them up because there are issues specific to girls at that age that place a whole set of pressures, as you said, on them.
And right. It's about self-esteem and it's about confidence. And it's also about opportunity, being what you can't see. And so we have one of these panels where we bring in women who are professionals in areas, whether it's coding in STEM, whether it's the kind of trade skills that you can go to trade school to get. We want to show the opportunities and what's possible for these young women. And that's really exciting and it's a lot of fun. The other thing I really think is really important is that leadership and leading communities, we could see it right now in this rather contentious time, is that if we learn to love each other and know each other when we're younger, we will grow up to learn and love each other and lead together. And so we make a tremendous effort to bring girls together from all across the four counties, actually. We actually speak to St. John's and Duval, but they show up from Nassau and Clay. And these are girls from the north side, the south side, the beaches. And they're there together learning what they have in common as young women and what they can do together.
And this is coming up on November 2nd, which is an early release day from school.
That's why we do it. We work with Duval County Public Schools. The principals call us and they send some buses from their schools, but it's November 2nd at UNF. But buses usually start rolling in between 1 and 1:30, and it gives girls a chance. Our signature piece is our mentor walk. So this is about the leaders of today, which is women like you, Melissa Ross. I hope you'll be there. Really being able to mentor the leaders of tomorrow.
You need more mentors, don't you?
We do. And we also want as wide of an expanse of girls to be interested in attending. And we've been growing like crazy.
That's great. And you're also starting some Gen Wow clubs in high schools. Is that right? Well, can you tell us about that?
I'd love to, because we didn't start it. The girls did.
Oh, really?
So we had some leadership councils. The girls are involved every year. And they called us and said, we want clubs in our schools. And so I think this year we have 5 of them. Beginning, I think we're at Rebolt, and we're at Ponte Vedra High School, and a couple of in between. And that's the beauty of this, I believe.
And again, this is coming up next week at the UNF campus. If you want to register to bring your daughter, it's genwownow.org. And not only will they get the benefit of this really exciting day, there will be follow-through and mentorship and support beyond the day.
Right. So we have our mentor walk, which is at the end of the incredibly energetic, insightful sessions. All the girls get paired up with a woman who has experience in an area they declare. And they walk for 45 minutes. And then they have the ability to connect, actually, for the rest of their lives. That's the hard part to teach young women, right? So, Melissa, you know, if you walk with a young girl and she calls you in 5 years, you remember me, you're going to say, yes, what can I do to help you?
Yeah.
The idea of building networks that way is powerful.
It really is. As you said a minute ago, you can't be what you can't see. And those networks have always existed for men. You're trying to create one for girls and young women so that they have those mentors and sponsors and those role models that they can turn to for advice and support and counsel, which, by the way, you've done for me. So thank you for that.
My pleasure. My pleasure. My pleasure.
And again, it's genwownow.org. Register now.
Is it that what it is? Gen Wow Now.
Okay. That's what Google tells me.
Okay.
coming up November 2nd on the UNF campus, make sure your daughter attends because she'll get to meet Donna Ornder, which is a pretty fabulous experience.
Actually, there'll be 120 spectacular women. And we're really, really excited about the ongoing work. And so we appreciate being able to share it with you and all your listeners.
Thank you so much. And that's November 2nd. In a moment, we're going to tell you why today is National Pumpkin Day. That's after this.
I love pumpkin.
From the panhandle to the peninsula, the Sunshine State's politics are as hot as the weather. Trump versus Clinton, the race for the U.S. Senate, new political boundaries and familiar issues. Join 89.9 every Friday at 1 p.m. for Decision Florida. Let your voice be heard.
Join WJCT and the Boy Scouts of America as they host a seminar on multigenerational wealth and philanthropic planning, Wednesday, November 2nd, 8 a.m. at WJCT Studios. This seminar is for financial planners, estate planning attorneys, and CPAs. Presentation by Tripp Gray from Jackson National. Continuing education credits are available. The seminar is free, but reservations are required. Info at wjct.org/events.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday through Saturday nights on 89.9 when we bring you music from around the world. All styles played, all songs considered. Join me for the Electro Lounge, Tuesday through Saturday nights.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, it's that time of year again when you just might see the great pumpkin. At least everything seems orange right now, not just the turning leaves. Actually, those are mostly up north. But we do find here in Florida the pumpkin spice in our latte, in our donuts at this time of October, honestly, in just about everything. But what about pumpkin makes it so popular? Did you know today is actually National Pumpkin Day? Well, we've got to jump on Halloween as we discuss this culinary trend with First Coast chef Michael Bump of Forking Amazing Restaurants. Good morning.
Good morning.
I love saying that, by the way. It's just such a clever title.
It gets a good reaction from people.
It really does. Now, okay, it's pumpkin season. You can't avoid it. It's in everything. This trend, this food trend, has really just exploded in the last few years. Why do you think that is?
I just think it's the pumpkin is such a seasonal product that when it comes out, people really look forward to it. It's something they don't get year-round. The flavor profiles are it's versatile, and
you can put it in everything. Almost
you can.
You can roast it, bake it, puree it, pair it with other things. You can put it in. Oh, by the way, I was told to not forget to mention Sinati's incredibly popular pumpkin donuts. That's a local organization, of course, a local food store. But if you go to Starbucks, it's pumpkin spice latte time. Mm-hmm. And to the point now where even people that like these pumpkin-based foods think that maybe it's getting a little too much. What do you think?
I definitely think it's a bit excessive. I mean, you go to the grocery store, you got pumpkin spice Cheerios, pumpkin spice Life, pumpkin spice oatmeal, and everything's pumpkin spice donuts from, you know, various bakeries. It's a bit excessive, but I still think that because it's such a seasonal product, people will enjoy it.
Sure, it comes and goes. Now, at Bistro X, you make a pumpkin macaroon. What are some other pumpkin flavor treats that you're making?
Nothing right now, but we will be doing a pumpkin bread pudding for the next, probably the next couple weeks as a dessert special.
That sounds nice. So. In fact, why didn't you just bring some of that with you? Because I think that would have been eaten very, very fast.
I think I thought of it this morning, that's why.
Now let's talk a little bit about Forking Amazing Restaurants, which is Ovinte, Bistro X, Il Desco, the new Calford Chop House downtown in Jacksonville.
Correct.
It's a whole suite of restaurants.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But tell us a little bit about the growth of Forking Amazing.
Oh, that's a tough one. honestly, I don't have a lot of information about it. It's a great restaurant group to work with. They're expanding. I know they're talking about doing another Block and Barrel, which is another building that they're working on. I think it's a distillery.
Another place, yeah. Sure. Now, in the meantime, you are going to be in the pages of Edible Northeast Florida with your pumpkin oatmeal cookie recipe.
Correct.
Is that right? People can actually make what you make.
Yeah. I had to come up with that recipe for that, so it was a trial and error.
Do you do that with all your recipes? You just experiment around till you find the exact right amount of ingredients?
Pretty much.
You don't follow a set cookbook or anything like that?
No. Occasionally, you sit there, you go to the internet for information and a little bit of inspiration, but most of the recipes are, okay, let's try this, let's switch this out, let's mix this with this, see what happens.
Sounds like fun.
Something like that.
Something like that. He's Michael Bump, First Coast chef with Forking Amazing Restaurants. Today is National Pumpkin Day. So enjoy. And thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app. And next on Diane Rehm, Affordable Care Act premiums will increase by an average of 25% next year. Guest host Susan Page and her guests look at the Affordable Care Act, rising costs, subsidies, and its future in the next administration. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.